Today is Monday, June 14th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden prepares for summit with President Putin.
President Joe Biden's high-stakes meeting this week in Geneva with Russian President Vladimir Putin will address a range of issues.
Plus, G7 leaders pledge action on COVID, climate change, and economy.
Despite the appearance of normality, the coronavirus pandemic overshadowed the summit, which ended with a pledge to end the outbreak and work to prevent similar ones in the future.
Also, UN seeks aid for Venezuela refugees. Our top story today is in the Brussels. U.S. President Joe Biden's summit this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to focus on improving relations between Washington and Moscow over a host of issues, including cyber attacks from people operating from Russia. Michelle Quinn reports.
President Joe Biden's high-stakes meeting this week in Geneva with Russian President Vladimir Putin will address a range of issues, including the jailing of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, whose anti-corruption groups were recently deemed extreme organizations by the Moscow City Court. Both leaders have said that U.S.-Russia relations are at a low point. The timing of the summit is a chance for Biden to see if the countries can have a more predictable, stable relationship. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken issued a warning, who spoke on ABC this week.
If Russia chooses to continue to act aggressively, to act recklessly, will respond forcefully, as the president's already done.
Biden's agenda will include recent cyber attacks in the United States against food and gas supplies from hackers suspected of being based in Russia. Biden is expected to ask for Russia to extradite suspected hackers to the U.S. Putin told Russia State TV that Moscow would do so on a condition. Washington agrees to the same thing. About half of all Americans say they trust Biden's ability to negotiate with Putin. According to an ABC Ipsos poll taken earlier this month, some lawmakers question whether Biden should even be meeting with Putin and question whether the U.S. president's steps so far have been tough enough, particularly in response to cyber attacks. Congressman Mike McCaul is a Republican from Texas. He spoke on ABC this week.
The president needs to demonstrate with Putin there will be consequences to your actions if you continue to do this. They have been mounting this up in the last just month and extraordinarily. I think sanctions are great, but I think it's time to start thinking about hitting back.
The two leaders are expected to talk about other issues, such as regional security, nuclear arms, and the environment. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Security has been beefed up around Brussels, including at national embassies, ahead of the NATO summit on Monday. U.S. President Joe Biden and Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan arrived on Sunday for the meeting of alliance members, where Russia, China, and cybersecurity are all on the agenda. NATO leaders are expected to label China as a security risk to the Western alliance for the first time, a day after the Group of Seven issued a statement on human rights and Taiwan that Beijing said slandered its reputation. The summit, described as, quote, pivotal moment, unquote, by Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, aims to show Biden that the alliance remains a central support for U.S. efforts to uphold peace and democracy around the world, including standing up to China and its rapid military rise.
There are, of course, opportunities, and we need to engage with China on issues like climate change, arms control. But China's military buildup, growing influence and coercive behavior also poses some challenges to our security.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Diplomats say the NATO summit's final communique would not call China an adversary, but would demonstrate concern, calling it a, quote, systematic, unquote, challenge to Atlantic security as it joins Russia with military drills, launches cyber attacks, and rapidly builds up its navy. President Biden said NATO is key to U.S. security.
We do not view NATO as a sort of a protection racket. We believe that NATO is vital to our ability to maintain American security for the next remainder of the century.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. Leaders of the G7 ended their three-day summit Sunday, committing to a series of actions to end the coronavirus pandemic, mitigate climate change, and rebuild the global economy. The group named China and Russia as sources of global security and economic threats. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kiwara has this report from Brussels, the next leg of U.S. President Joe Biden's European tour.
An air show by the British Red Arrows and a reception with Queen Elizabeth. G7 summit host British Prime Minister Boris Johnson pulled out all the stops to facilitate this meeting with leaders of the world's seven wealthiest democracies, their first in person since 2019.
There has been a fantastic degree of harmony.
Despite the appearance of normality, the coronavirus pandemic overshadowed the summit, which ended with a pledge to end the outbreak and work to prevent similar ones in the future.
Leaders have pledged over 1 billion doses, either directly or through funding to COVAX.
Activists say it's not enough. They demand that rich countries, which are accused of hoarding vaccines, do more, including waiving intellectual property rights for vaccines at the World Trade Organization. U.S. President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron support the waiver, but the rest of the G7 opposes it. Climate activist Richard Eccleston.
We know that donations are not going to get us out of this crisis. What we needed to see was the G7 leaders coming together and to commit to lift the patents on these vaccines and share the recipes so that developing countries can make these vaccines for themselves.
China, which is not a G7 member, was a focus of the talks. President Biden pushed leaders to call out Beijing's forced labor practices and unwillingness to play by international trade rules. The group announced a U.S.-sponsored infrastructure financing mechanism for low- and middle-income countries called Build Back Better World to rival China's Belt and Road Initiative, the global infrastructure strategy central to Beijing's foreign policy. President Joe Biden.
We think that there's a much more equitable way to provide for the needs of countries around the world. And so it's a values-driven, high-standard, transparent financing mechanism we're going to provide.
China hit back by saying that the days when global decisions were dictated by a small group of countries are long gone. Russia, kicked out of the G8 in 2014 following Moscow's annexation of Crimea, was also called out for its destabilizing behavior, including cyber attacks and chemical weapons use against individuals opposed to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Autocrats have enormous power. They don't have to answer to a public.
On climate change, leaders committed to meet an overdue spending pledge of $100 billion a year to help developing countries cope with global warming. Despite activists' pressure, only two nations, Canada and Germany, gave specific cash amounts. Climate activist Richard Eccleston.
They're basically painting a story like they're doing what needs to be done for the climate and ecological emergency. But we know that they're not.
After an audience with the Queen Sunday evening, Biden flew to Brussels to attend summits with NATO and the European Union. From Brussels, Patsy Widas-Kiwara, VOA News.
The Biden administration is assessing a reported leak at China's Taishan nuclear power plant, but does not believe the facility is at a, quote, crisis level, unquote, yet, CNN reported on Monday, citing unnamed U.S. officials and documents it reviewed. While U.S. officials so far have determined the situation, Guangdong, China, does not, quote, pose a severe safety threat to workers at the plant or Chinese public, unquote, CNN said the U.S. government spent the past week monitoring the situation and convening meetings of its National Security Council. The French nuclear firm EDF, the majority owner of the plant, said it had requested an extraordinary meeting of the power plant's board for, quote, management to present all the data and the necessary decisions. The company said the plant is operating within safety parameters. After more than 12 years of a government headed by Likud leader Benjamin Netanyahu and four inconclusive elections, Israel has a new government. It is a coalition of eight parties from left to right and for the first time includes an Arab party. It was approved by a vote of 6-59 in the parliament. Naftali Bennett of the right-wing Yamana party will serve as prime minister for 2 years, followed by centrist Yair Lapid. Linda Granstein reports for VOA.
There were celebrations with foam and confetti in the streets of Tel Aviv Sunday night after Benjamin Netanyahu officially stepped down. Many here had been demonstrating against Netanyahu for many months and saw his loss as a victory. Earlier in the Israeli parliament, incoming Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was repeatedly heckled, and several hardline Knesset members were thrown out of the chamber.
Benjamin Netanyahu,
Bennett is 49 years old, the child of American parents, and the first Israeli prime minister to be religiously observant. During his maiden speech, he waited patiently for the heckling to subside before continuing. He said he would be the prime minister of all Israelis, including those who didn't vote for him, and promised to open a new chapter with Israel's Arab citizens. Bennett's coalition of eight parties includes an Arab party, Ra'am, for the first time in the state of Israel's history. Arab citizens make up 20% of Israel's population and say they have been routinely discriminated against. Political scientist Guy Ben-Porat says that including an Arab party in the government is significant.
We have an Arab party which is in the government and has been legitimized, even if for a moment, also by the right-wing Likud. So this could signal a change for the future, where Arab citizens are equal partners in the political life of Israel.
When it came his turn to speak, outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sharply attacked Bennett as a liar and promised to return to power soon. He said that there are celebrations in Iran, implying that Bennett will not be able to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power. He also said that he will work day and night to get rid of Bennett's leftist government and that the new government will fall faster than many think. Palestinians say they do not expect any change in Israel's policies under the new prime minister. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Carol Castillo, host of VOA's Encounter radio program, spoke with Nathan Sachs, director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, about how Israel's new government may deal with Arab relations.
This government will have to deal with the Palestinian issue. That will be very difficult and complicated, especially when it touches on issues such as Jerusalem and policing in Jerusalem and the settlements. But I do not think it will find itself really confronting the question of the long-term borders and citizenry of Israel. Is it one state, two, three, or whatever? And I'll add one more point. Since really these questions of on the ground and conflict management will become crucial, unfortunately, I wish there was chance for conflict resolution, but I do not judge it to be the case. That means that some of the ministers, for example, the new minister for internal security, Omer Bar-Lev, will be very important. He comes from labor, from the left. He's an experienced man with a military background, and in fact will probably be much more responsible and able and well-intentioned than the current minister of internal security, who was selected for the job mostly because of his loyalty to Benjamin Netanyahu. And so some subtle changes like that, for example, the appointment of someone I think very able and qualified like Omer Bar-Lev, could actually be much more important than the ideological differences between Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, who disagree, but both agree that it's completely irrelevant right now.
And what about the role of Arab countries, particularly our allies like Jordan and Egypt? Can they make a difference? How will they interact with the new coalition in Israel? And what about the so-called countries of the Abraham Accords?
I think for many countries around the world, but in particular for countries like Jordan, there will be a bit of a difference in how they relate to different parts of the government. They will find solace in the fact that the foreign minister is in charge of foreign affairs, and so they will therefore deal with the foreign minister, Yair Lapid. They'll probably have less appetite to dealing with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. There's also a president of Israel, Yitzhak Herzog, who used to be the leader of the Labor Party from the left. That's another person that Jordan, for example, might find it quite easy to deal with. Not that they will necessarily boycott Naftali Bennett, but I think they will find the ways to deal, especially with Lapid and perhaps with Gantz, who has a lot of authority as Minister of Defense.
That's Director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, Nathan Sachs, speaking with VOA's Encounter host, Carol Castillo. Reports of anti-Asian violence across the U.S. have filled headlines recently, but anti-Asian sentiments is also surfacing online. VOA's Tina Trin reports.
An increasing number of violent attacks against Asians in the U.S. have come to light, but the abuse is also happening online. 17% of Asian Americans reported experiencing severe online harassment, according to a January survey conducted by the Anti-Defamation League, a jump from 11% the previous year.
When it comes to online harassment, 75% of Asian adults who experienced harassment said it was due to their race and ethnicity. And that's actually a slightly higher share than Black and Hispanic adults who also experienced online harassment.
Sei Chung is editor-in-chief at Morning Consult, an online polling firm. The company surveyed 1,000 Asian adults in March and found that 29% had experienced online harassment, with 58% of incidents happening on social media. Chung says the impact of the harassment may be worse than what's been reported.
So a lot of Asians, like because they don't talk about mental health issues openly, suffer in silence. And what our data shows is that they're not alone.
The online environment is our environment now, and that affects people. And if it's being said online, it needs to be taken seriously as it would offline.
University of California professor Yulin Xuan has studied the proliferation of anti-Asian hashtags on Twitter.
Hashtags are really, you know, the new type of graffiti on the wall. It's a way to identify yourself to a particular group. It's a way to find people with similar ideologies.
Xuan and her fellow researchers analyzed more than 700,000 Chinese virus hashtags in March of 2020 and found that half were combined with anti-Asian hashtags.
It creates this really racist belief against these people and has real-world consequences.
It's harder to determine whether a cause and effect relationship exists between online sentiment and real-world violence, but Xuan says it's worth investigating.
At some point, we need to see that these correlations and these signals are so large that they can't be ignored anymore.
While online hate speech is contagious, the opposite is true too, says Georgia Tech professor Srijan Kumar.
If we can start spreading counter speech messages, if we can support, encourage, and express solidarity towards and defend Asian entities, then that essentially creates a cascade effect.
Kumar says exposure to counter speech can potentially discourage users from turning hateful. In the fight against online hate, these experts say it's about the power of words. Tina Trin, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. Myanmar's ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi is going on trial on charges of human rights observers say are part of the military junta's efforts to delegitimize her democratic election and cripple her political future. The prosecution of Aung San Suu Kyi opening Monday poses the greatest challenge so far for the 75-year-old and her National League for Democracy party since the military takeover in February. An opposition center-right party has come in on top in Sunday's local elections in Finland ahead of Prime Minister Sanna Marin's ruling Social Democratic Party. It was the first election challenge since the popular young leader took office 18 months ago. With all votes counted in the Nordic nation's municipal elections, initial results Monday showed that the Conservative National Coalition Party has taken 21.4% of the votes nationwide, while the Social Democrats took 17.7%, and the Center Party, 14.9% of the votes. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. UN agencies are appealing for international support for 5.6 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants who have fled persecution and economic hardship and taking refuge in countries in the region. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Venezuelan refugee and migrant displacement crisis is one of the largest the world has ever seen, second only to Syria. UN officials say it has not received the visibility it deserves. Michael Grant is Assistant Deputy Minister for the Americas Global Affairs Canada. Grant says this lack of visibility is depriving the Venezuelans and host countries of the humanitarian assistance needed for them to thrive. He says this is causing more suffering for millions of people who already have endured so much distress.
The lives of nearly 6 million people have been upended, forced to leave their homes with little or no possessions in search of safety, security, and dignity, walking in some instances thousands of kilometers to find refuge.
At the end of their journey, he says, countries in South and Central America and the Caribbean have offered the Venezuelans shelter, healthcare, education, and security. But he says this generosity is unsustainable without more international support. Grant says the Venezuelan crisis is amplified by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has hit the Latin American and Caribbean region particularly hard. He says the pandemic has had a particularly severe impact on women, children, and vulnerable groups.
Over half don't have enough to eat. 80 to 90% have lost their source of income. 1 in 4 children are separated from their families during the journey, and women and girls experience particular challenges such as gender-based violence and lack of access to sexual and reproductive health services.
UN agencies report millions of impoverished Venezuelans are in dire straits and dependent upon humanitarian assistance for survival. Canada, in collaboration with the UN Refugee Agency, an international organization for migration, is hosting an international donors conference on behalf of Venezuelan refugees and migrants on June 17th. The agency say $1.44 billion is needed to provide life-saving aid to the 5.6 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants this year. They note half the year is gone, and only 5% of this amount has been funded. They are appealing to governments to use this week's pledging conference to fill this gap. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Conservationists have praised Australian authorities' work to drastically reduce the amount of plastic waste and eliminate some disposable coffee cups. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The New South Wales state government wants to ban many common plastic items, including straws, drink stirrers and cutlery, as well as polystyrene cups, in a bid to protect the environment and reduce waste. Lightweight plastic shopping bags could be eliminated within 6 months of new laws being passed. The reforms could be approved by lawmakers this year. Other products will be phased out at different times, depending on the availability of, for example, paper and bamboo alternatives. Officials have estimated the measures will stop about 2.7 billion items of plastic from ending up in the environment and oceans over the next 20 years. New South Wales Environment Minister Matt Keane has warned that the world is on track to have more plastic in the ocean than fish by 2050. He told Australian television that the changes would help protect the community.
No one wants to be wading through plastics when they go to the beach, let alone be consuming it in their food and water. And that's what we're doing at the moment. Every day in New South Wales, people are consuming over 2,000 bits of plastic. That's the equivalent of a credit card of plastic they're ingesting every week. And it's largely because of the pervasiveness of single-use plastics across our environment. So we believe that we can do something about that, do something about it where there are alternatives available and when it doesn't add to cost. And that's what I'm looking to see.
In Western Australia, the state government has also announced ambitious plans to tackle waste. By the end of this year, it will ban a range of items, including single-use plastic bowls, plates, straws, polystyrene food containers, and thick plastic shopping bags. Polystyrene packaging and takeaway plastic coffee cups and their lids will be outlawed in 2022. It's estimated that Australians throw out about 1 billion coffee cups each year. The World Wildlife Fund Australia said the state governments in New South Wales and Western Australia are in a race to the top in waste measures and that the reforms were a terrific outcome for the environment. But conservationists have warned that Tasmania and the Northern Territory were the only Australian jurisdictions without a plan to ban problem single-use plastics. Also, in a few weeks, it will be illegal for companies to export certain waste plastics from Australia under tough new rules. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.